Okay, so it's the top of the hour. So I guess let's get started. Welcome to the Peace Alliance monthly call for the month of December. And there's a few people I can see, like Kathleen and Ngozi, just to make sure that I'm not accidentally muted. Wave your hand if you can hear me. Thank you. All right, terrific. So I'm Dan Kahn, I'm the National Field Coordinator for the Peace Alliance, and it's a pleasure to be with you, and I really thank you all for joining us. Tonight's call, we're going to be focusing largely on the truth and reconciliation process that can take place here in the United States. And it's a process regarding our history of racial violence that one avenue towards truth and reconciliation has been opened by the Equal Justice Initiative, an organization that created the National Peace and Justice Memorial and Legacy Museum in Montgomery, Alabama. So those who've been following our emails and have been on previous calls about this are more familiar with this. This institution is also known as colloquially as the Lynching Museum. And tonight we're going to hear from a county commissioner, Robert Carl Hutchinson, known to many folks as Hutch, who's a commissioner in Alachua County, Florida, where they're in the process of working to address their own legacy of racial violence and to reclaim, to claim the monument that will indicate some of the racial violence that's taken place in Alachua County and begin a discussion about this. So in a moment, I'm going to turn the floor over to Hutch to talk about that for a little while. Then we'll have some question and answer time. And then we're going to go into looking at our action, which we're asking folks to take these months. I'd love for folks to check your inboxes, your email inboxes, because in the last 40 minutes or so, you should have all received two things, two links. One of them will be the action sheet for November and December, and there's some information that'll help you take that action. And the other link will lead you to a sample op-ed piece, because the action for this month, we're asking folks to craft your own op-ed and then submit it to local regional publication. On this topic. So I've sent a link to an op-ed that I've drafted, and you can feel free to plagiarize as much as you like. And we'll get more into the details of the action a little bit later in the call. And then we're going to hear an update from the Department of Peacebuilding Committee's representative on the call, Kendra Mann. And then we're going to have some time to hear from all of you, any of you that wants to share what you've been up to, what's happening in your world of peace building, conflict resolution, violence reduction in your neighborhoods, in your schools, in your state, or in your work. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to introduce Hutch, who is not only is a county commissioner, but has been an executive director of both the Alachua Conservation Trust and also the Southeastern Forest Trust. So he's been a steady advocate and worker and organizer to preserve really important ecological treasures and resources. He's a county commissioner in a county where I lived for over 9 years, and I just have a lot of personal respect and appreciation for him as a real steady, clear, and dedicated voice for representing what I think of as a very sensible approach to development, to preservation, to negotiations. So I really have a lot of appreciation for him and his work and for having him here on our call. Let me go ahead and unmute you. Okay, Hutch, your mic is open. We'd love to hear from you about this truth and reconciliation process and where it's at.
Good. Well, thank you very much, Dan. So Alachua County is in north central Florida. We're a little blue dot in a huge sea of red politically, and we have the University of Florida here. So student activism is a big part of our traditions. So a couple of years ago, when many communities in the wake of the South Carolina shootings started questioning Confederate monuments, we had Old Joe, who was right in front of the county administration building. And a rather innocuous statue, but it had a couple of inscriptions around it that were sort of classic, Reconstruction era, lost cause type inscriptions. So there was a movement to get rid of Old Joe, and we did it peacefully the day after the Charlottesville murder. And we had been working on it for a year and a half, but that was really the first sort of recent taste of public conversations about racial justice, because we had hours and hours of testimony at our county commission meetings about why we should move the monument, and of course people on both sides of it, or many sides of the argument. So fast forward a little bit to March of this year, and I was up at the march in Washington after the Parkland shootings, and was lucky enough to get into the National Museum of African American History, and was pretty blown away by the degree to which history has, just accurate history, has not been taught. I got a very expensive education, including in history, and I've worked as the development director for many years for a museum. My wife was on the founding board of the local history museum here, and yet I really felt there's a lot of fascinating history, troubling history, that needs to get out there. So that was in March. And then in May, just after the lynching memorial and the accompanying museum in Montgomery opened up, my wife and I toured it. And then again in October, we took a busload of 56 people, half NAACP members and half members of our United Churches Racial Equity Task Force. So the 56 of us toured the museum, toured the monument, and then had a great talk, question and answer session by Equal Justice Initiative staff members. And I'd strongly recommend that if and when you go to the memorial in the museum, see if you can book an hour with those folks, because they are wise. They teach you how to answer really tough questions in ways that everybody was surprised at. So it's a very inspiring place. So a little bit about my reactions to it. First of all, I'm a firm believer. I really love to go to monuments and memorials, and have done them all over the world. And I would put the Montgomery experience in the top five. It's the equivalent of seeing the Statue of Liberty, the Vietnam Memorial, or you know, any of the other very dramatic memorials. It works at all scales. It works at the very detailed micro scale, and then it works as a whole piece. And the brilliant part of it, the truly brilliant part of it, is the 800 slabs, each for a county where there was a racial lynching, that the counties get to claim and take back and display in their own way. So it's a monument that will literally cover a big chunk of the United States when the when everybody has claimed their memorial. And so you can go, first of all, you see your county's memorial hanging there in the main hall, but then on the exit, you walk past the duplicate of it laying down there, and you can see, there it is. We haven't claimed our memorial yet because we haven't done the truth and reconciliation work. Now, the Equal Justice Initiative has not published their guidelines for what it will require of a county to claim their piece of the memorial. They've hinted that it will be truth and reconciliation work. We're sure there'll be some sort of checklist. We're sure that our county will be able to achieve that checklist. There's an interesting internal debate. Should we do the minimum, claim our memorial, get it down here, and have it be the centerpiece for additional conversations and education and all that? Or should we do much harder, more thorough and comprehensive work, and only when we're satisfied that we've done everything should we feel that we deserve to go up there and claim our monument? So that's a debate that may well happen 800 times in this country, because but we'll know more when EJI comes out with their criteria. Now, the what we're doing here in Alachua County is We have decided to take a decentralized approach to truth and reconciliation. What you'll find if you do any reading in the subject matter, and whether it's South Africa or Canada or Greensboro or Barbados or any of the places that have done truth and reconciliation processes, quite often they appoint a blue ribbon commission of a bunch of important sounding people, and it's usually a very big board, 25 folks or more, and they work on that report and they have some public meetings, and at the end they've got something to deliver. And often a lot of people feel left out, or it doesn't feel like it was thorough enough, or not enough people end up reading the results to make a difference. So we're taking a little bit different approach, and I don't know if it's unique, but anyway, here's how we're doing it. Each local government or agency or organization or even individual is going to do their own truth and reconciliation process. And so the Alachua County Commission, we know what the four corners of our role was during the Jim Crow era. We know that we used prison labor to build our roads. We can probably estimate, based on the fact that we know a lot of, but we still have a lot of records. We've digitized all of our county commission handwritten minutes all the way back to the 1850s. So we can go into those minutes, do searches, and we, for instance, can see who paid for the taxes on the slaves that they owned. We've also done this for deeds and probate instruments. So we have one of the most comprehensive digital records of any southern county. And it was all done by volunteers, and we've been doing it for 10 years, so it's not like you can do this overnight. But because we've done it, we can now go through our records and find all kinds of fascinating information that has to do with our history, and more particularly our racial history. And so we're going to figure out those areas where maybe we were involved in voter suppression, or where we were complicit in kicking, particularly in the early parts of the Reconstruction era, kicking black elected officials out of office who had been justly elected. And there's a lot of historical things that happened within the bounds of county government that we're going to do as thorough a job as we can with primary documents and put all the information out there. And we're also going to interpret it. And we're also going to do some accounting work. We're going to figure out how much was it worth that all of our roads, or predominantly our roads, were built by leased prison labor. And we're going to bring those numbers to the future so we can at least get a sense of the scale of what we're doing. But what we're not doing is we're not telling our separately elected sheriff that how she has to do her truth and reconciliation process. We know that there were sheriff's deputies who tied nooses around people. We even know some of their names. We know that the criminal justice system in general never prosecuted any significant number of people for all kinds of racial terrorism. But we know that the University of Florida was segregated up into the 50s and 60s, and that even now has serious racial problems going on campus. We're not going to tell the university how they have to do what they do. We're not going to tell the realtors, you guys redlined, or the bankers, you guys denied mortgages, or any of the other institutions, the local municipalities. We're not going to tell them how to do their work. What we intend to do is do such a good job of it within county government that everybody else will see that it's safe to do it, that it's smart to do it, that it's desirable to do it. And what the county will do is put up a very robust website that becomes the sort of digital archives where anybody can peruse through there and see what's been done, all the way from individual stories up to institutional stories. So that will be the truth part of it. Before reconciliation, often there's a step called reparations. And then we're going to figure out, at least for county government, what would reparations look like. And we think, for instance, that a recently passed referendum called the Children's Trust, which will largely target $7 million a year, which is a lot for us, towards early childhood developmental evening out. We think that we can count that on part of the ledger. We think there's many other things that we're doing right today in terms of affordable housing and in terms of other things that we can start to count on the ledger. And there'll be robust debates about that. And that's part of what makes this so interesting and so worthwhile. So we're going to account for all those things. I can tell you that when the county commission saw that there were 18 names on the slab at the Equal Justice Initiative for the lynching victims in our county, we said, we don't think that's everybody. And so we made a referral to our historical commission, which are a bunch of history buffs that are appointed by the county commission. So they have a semi-formal role, and said, gave them 6 months, see who else you can find. And they came back with 43 victims. So we went from 18 to 43, which makes us, you know, one of the more lynchings in our county than virtually anywhere, except that nobody else has done that work. And so we think when the other counties dig more deeply than the Equal Justice Initiative was able to, they too will double or triple the number of lynchings in their county. And that is part of the truth work as well. So anyway, that's kind of the overview. I'll say where we are now is, having just come back from this trip, we came back, we debriefed, we lit candles for each and named each of the victims that had names. And then we talked about what each of us were going to do next. Some people are going to run big reading groups, like 500 people reading the same book at the same time, community reads. We do that in our community quite a bit. And there's a half a dozen books that are now vying for the top spot. And so we'll pick one of those and probably do that in January and February. And we plan to have a symposium where we bring in several nationally well-known leaders in this area of endeavor, and, you know, have a conference here that outsiders can come to, but we're going to primarily be aiming it at what we should be doing locally. County government is going to do our work, and we've already got the draft of the website. It's not online where you can see it yet, but it will be soon. It looks great. It's very functional. It makes it easy to navigate and read stories and come to conclusions. And so we think that will play a significant role. And then there's a lot of other suggestions. And the nice thing about this is there's at least a dozen different fronts that are working on this. The Gainesville Sun, our paper, whose publisher in the 1920s was a member of the Ku Klux Klan, they have decided to emulate the New York Times, who is publishing obituaries of people who they should have published obituaries for, you know, sometimes 100 years ago. And so what they have done is they have hired a journalism graduate class from the University of Florida to write obituaries for the 43 lynching victims, everything they can find. So you've got these J students who are digging deep and finding out everything they possibly can by talking to current family members, descendants, about what is the oral history of these folks, and anything else they can find out about how they lived and how they died. And so, so there, again, there's lots of little fronts in how we're working this. So I'll shut up and happily answer any questions, and then listen for what you guys want to talk about.
Thanks, Hutch. That's just from my instant perspective, that's really amazing and deep. And that's like a syllabus for addressing this. I really appreciate the thoroughness. Before I get into question and answer, I want to also introduce my co-host for the call, Ngozi Rashida Akosia. Ngozi and I have been sort of looking at this topic for 6 or 8 months, and had a few field calls on the subject. And it's definitely been a shared endeavor to think through how we want to move forward and what's coming up for us around it. So Ngozi is with us, and we'll be talking more about her writing process a little bit later in the call, as well as offering us a guided meditation to sort of center ourselves emotionally for where we want to be moving forward with this. So folks who have a question for Hutch or want to add to the discussion, you should have a hand raise icon on your screen. If you have the app downloaded, or if you have the hardware, the software rather, on your computer. If you're on your phone, you can press *9 to raise your hand, and I'll be able to recognize you. I see a hand go up. I don't see a name attached, but it's in the 510 area code. It's 510, and the number ends in 663. So you're unmuted. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Nancy Merritt in the California area. Thank you for the discussion. I'm interested in the books you might recommend. We were at the African American Museum when we were in Washington, and I got a book called Blood at the Root by Patrick Phillips, which is quite amazing and sad. But anyway, I'm wondering what books, some book recommendations from you.
Well, the I'm probably not the best person to talk about that. We have a senior librarian at the University of Florida Library who's actually working on that. I mean, I've read some stuff along the way, but we will be publishing. We actually have a fellow who, interestingly enough, started collecting original books in Germany about the rise of anti-Semitism. And in the course of doing that, there are all these pictures of lynchings in America, lynchings of African Americans in America, in the books about anti-Semitism as the rise of Nazism was looking towards role models. And then when he moved to Florida, he then started collecting the same kind of books here. And I went down and looked at his collection the other day, and there is a robust literature from the anti-lynching movements of the 1920s and 1930s and 1940s that are essentially unknown to us. I mean, they've been out of publication for, you know, 60 years or 80 years. And so he had several of those that I thought would be fascinating, because there was a very strong anti-lynching movement in this country then, both black people and white people. And a lot of people wrote about it back then, including their firsthand experience of racial terror. I know that I did read a book called Anatomy of a Lynching, and it was set in, it was an actual lynching set in the panhandle of Florida. And the reason the guy chose this one to write about is it had all of the characteristics, all the ritualistic characteristics that sort of evolved in the way that lynchings were done, and how the crowds were whipped up, and, you know, the response of the constabulary and that sort of thing, and how the news media responded to it. So you could essentially read that book and you would have read about the vast majority of the 4,000 lynchings, because they kind of developed a certain pattern. And if you don't know too much about it, then I would recommend that as a in terms of just a lynching. The other thing that's interesting is the broader history that surrounded the end of Reconstruction and the beginning of the Black Codes and the Jim Crow era. And there's a bunch of good books, including some fairly contemporary history books about that now that are worth reading. So sorry I wasn't more specific with a reading list, but I'm actually not the best one to ask that question.
Is that something you might post on the website?
Yeah, I'd be very, and actually that guy that I talked about, he's going to be doing an annotated bibliography of his stuff, and that should be available relatively soon, and he's got a very interesting collection.
Thank you.
Thanks, Nancy. A few other hands up. The next one is also from a telephone, and it's the 251 area code, and it ends in 924. Whoever you are unmuted.
Hi, Hi, this is Sherry Graham from Mobile, Alabama. I have to commend the county commissioner for the proactive response that your county as an elected official is taking. Brian Stevenson, for most of you who, if you don't know, who started EJI and was responsible for the museum in Montgomery, just was here a week ago. He's been in this area twice, once last year in one county and now this year in Mobile County. The challenge that we had, there was so much going on and we're rallying around and really trying to work together to understand how we can become more respectful, more peaceful, and build a healthier community. But from his being here last year and this year, the numbers increased. What he said was the same. I'm hoping that our county officials can take what you've set forth to do, and I'm certainly going to recommend that we follow what you're doing because we face so much adversity within a diverse culture here in South Alabama that sometimes I feel like we've gone backwards and we're not moving forward because there's still so much blame, there's still so much antagonistic attitude. And changing culture, I've worked in the past 3 years in the mental health arena, and I can tell you that it's a slow process. So I am excited. You just now energized. But I do have a question. What county in Florida are you in? I think I missed that part in the beginning.
We're in a county called Alachua, spelled with an A. It's the very first county alphabetically. So it's A-L-A-C-H-U-A. And our local paper is the Gainesville Sun. And you can go to their website. And over the past couple months, there's been a lot of editorials. And especially if you look in... If you go to their opinion section and go to other voices, when people write columns, you'll see them. And there's been two or three really good ones. And so you'll see some of the writing about it there.
Thank you for sharing that. Because I'm going to pass it on to let our other elected officials know throughout the country that the approach you're taking to bring the past history forward in such a way that there's an economic factor tied to what happened in the past to where we are today. So
exactly.
Thank you.
Well, here's a figure that will blow your mind. In 1920, in the state of Alabama, 78% of the entire state revenue was from prisoner leasing. In other words, the state was leasing their prisoners and running the entire, I mean, three quarters of the state government was run off just the proceeds from prisoner leasing. So, Florida wasn't far behind. Yeah.
And for those of you, if you've not read Brian Stevenson's book, Just Mercy, that is what this community, we had 5,000 copies distributed free through Starbucks and other libraries. And we had 5,000 people reading his book during the month of October and November prior to his coming. So the impact is there. I'm glad that I'm back on board. Thank you, Dan. Hello, Dan. It's good to see you again. But thank you, Mr. County Commissioner, because I look forward to following what you're doing now to hopefully inspire other county commissions to begin the process. And ironically, we had a discussion this week about the history of Mobile and how we can create a different universe and thinking here. So I'm hoping that this will be that catalyst to help.
Well, here's two interesting tidbits. One is that one of our small communities, which had a disproportionate number of lynchings, named Newberry, Florida, they got started and they had a public meeting. They've had a couple meetings, but then they had one that was an open mic, and they had a few people kick it off with some short stories about their own family histories, both some of them as slave owners and some of them as descendants from slaves. And And then the open mic was really dramatic because one by one, people got up there and really started opening up and telling what they had heard about the lynchings that happened less than 100 years ago. And so some of them had heard from their grandparents who were there. And then other people got up and just started expressing how much they loved everybody for being willing to talk about this very difficult stuff. And you could just feel a wave of relief go through the room because the room was half black and half white. And it's in a kind of a conservative rural community. And I was pretty much blown away. And then on the Sunday before Thanksgiving, all of the churches in that community, 12 churches in that community, each preached truth and reconciliation from the pulpit. And then all of the parishioners came together in the park and broke bread together, had a big Thanksgiving supper. Again, black and white all mixed in. And again, in the small town rural South, church is one of the last really segregated places. And so it was really quite moving. And that just happened, a few weeks ago. So we're moving in the right direction, and it feels real good.
That's really beautiful, Hutch. I'm glad we got to that story. And thank you, Sherry. Yeah, it's good to hear from you too. I have sort of a follow-up question about that. I'm curious as two things. One, has there been much like county to county dialogue? Is there a place where you talk with other county commissioners from other places? But the second part of that is also, to not to take any initiative away from citizens to have those conversations with their commissioners. Do you have sort of any advice or suggestions about how those dialogues might proceed? So both of those things, you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, well, first, county commissioners have a national organization and each one has a state organization. And I'm not really aware of any significant movements in those organizations to talk about it, but I intend pretty soon to write an article for the national and the state newsletters or magazines that go out just to talk about what we're doing and hopefully inspire them. In terms of people interacting with their elected officials, the county commissioners are probably the single most accessible elected officials because, we're not the state guys or the Congress guys or even school board members who, are browbeaten so much. So I would say in terms of dealing with a level of government, the county is where the rubber meets the road, and it's really easy to get us on the phone. Most of us have open office hours. I don't screen a single phone call or appointment, so anybody can literally say, I want to get on a schedule or call directly. My cell phone number's published, so I get calls 24/7. So it's pretty easy to talk to county commissioners, and they will have to understand the benefits for doing this, but particularly if you want to be on the front edge of this, I think there's tremendous benefits in just showing that you're an open community. So if your commission is more, if their philosophy is more like, how can we be more business friendly? One of the ways you can be more business friendly is to demonstrate to the world that you're open and accepting and affirming and just and all that sort of stuff. Now, there's a lot of ways to do that, and primarily within the criminal justice system. And so a lot of what we're going to be doing is, after we do the hard, truthy history stuff, it's going to be how we're going to fix our criminal justice system. And I would suggest you look at the Bronx Defenders as somebody who might want to come down and speak to your public defender or your judiciary, because they do an incredible job of talking about the collateral damage of the sentencing and the way that our criminal justice system works on people, because somebody will be up in front of a judge and they've, a relatively minor crime, but because of the 30 days in jail that they spent, they've lost their job because of something else. They may have, you know, lost custody of their children because they have to go to these probation meetings once a week. It costs them a day of work and on and on and on. And so what the Bronx defenders have learned how to do is make the sentences make a lot more sense and to cut down on all the collateral damage of jailing people and so forth. So we're now to the point where nobody spends a night in jail here in Alachua County if their bond is set at $1,000 or less. We just turn them loose because it's not worth whatever that cost is to society and to them and to us to have them spend a night in jail, even on something that requires $1,000 bond. And so there's a lot of things that they can teach your community about how to make the justice system work more justly.
Hmm. Wonderful. Well, that's great stuff. This is really rich. And I want to remind everyone and let Hutch know, I hadn't mentioned it, that this call is recorded. So if you want to use this information as a resource to go back and make your outline, make any plans, this will be available on our website within a few days. I see there's one more hand up, but we're over time for this section, and I do want to get to everything that's in our plans. So, Hutch, if folks have other questions, can they email you? Is there an easy email for them to reach out?
Yeah, my email is very simple. It's Hutch, and then the letters RK. So Hutch, RK, at AOL.com.
Perfect. Okay. So as I mentioned to you earlier, Hutch, you are welcome to stay with us for the rest of the call, but I understand you told me earlier that you came before here, you were in an almost a 12-hour county commission meeting, so it may be time for you to put your feet up or take a walk on the prairie or whatever is up next for you. So I wanted to
good. Really thank you so much, you. Dan. I've really enjoyed it, and thanks for all the good work you guys are doing. Cheers.
Pleasure. Yeah, good night. All right. So I very much enjoyed that. I hope you guys did too. And it's inspiring. It's very grounding to me to hear about, okay, practically, how do you do this? How does one do this in an organized, orderly, inspiring way? And that story about the open mic in Newbury and how it led to 12 churches preaching about truth and reconciliation and then breaking bread together. I got chills when I heard about that. Folks who have been following the emails and have taken a look at the links that I sent would be aware that we're asking folks to work on an op-ed to submit to your local paper or regional paper in support of this. And in a little bit, Ngozi is going to talk with us about her writing process. And then we're also going to talk about sort of future actions around this. Just a preview, we also are going to schedule a call for a week from tonight. Everyone who's on this call will send you a link to register for another call a week from tonight, where we'll take, if you've worked on op-eds during this week, then we'll have a little time to workshop it a week from tonight, and we'll talk about pitching the op-ed to your local papers or your regional papers. So we're going to encourage folks to work on the op-ed these next 6 or 7 days. Get it in a condition that you're pretty happy with it. You can use the sample that I've sent. You can use the guidelines that I've shared. And then we can come back together next Tuesday, and again, we'll send you that link. So before we hear about Ngozi's process of writing and addressing this project, she's, I believe, going to give us a little guided meditation to sort of go from taking in all this information to moving into a centered place where we're ready to take action in a way that we're happy about. So if I can unmute you, there you are. Welcome, Ngozi.
Thank you so much, Dan. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, very good. So that was a lot to take in. It was really wonderful. So I'm just going to invite each and every one of us at this time just to find a restful, relaxed position for your body and allow yourself to just release any tension in your shoulders, in your neck area, your lower back, allowing your feet to touch the floor or whatever feels comfortable for you. If you feel comfortable, this is a great time to just close your eyes and just allow yourself to be very centered and still in this moment, just this moment. and allow yourself to continue to be more and more present to this moment, just listening to my voice, listening to your own heartbeat, allowing yourself to breathe easily, effortlessly, as you hear these words. And then we'll have a moment of silence, complete silence, where we can just be still and tap into that center place within each and every one of us. So as we walk into this meditation, just really allowing ourselves to release any thoughts, ideas, anything that came before this moment, allowing ourselves to release frustrations, irritations, anger, disappointments, release everything that we've known up until this day so that we can just be totally available and aware to this moment and to be receptive to a deeper understanding, an opportunity to embrace a sense of respectfulness at a deeper level, an opportunity to cultivate peace within ourselves, within our language, within our thoughts, within our ways of being, our lifestyle, our communities. And as we just embrace these wonderful gifts that we have that are available to us at any moment that we choose, we get to anchor into that. We get to anchor into the harmony, the balance, the peace, the joy, the love for our communities, our families, humanity itself. Just knowing that we are each here for one another, for our families, for our communities. And we take this into the silence. We take it into the silence with a deeper sense of willingness, of openness, of availability. So slowly, slowly, slowly start to bring yourself back to the present moment. Remember to just be available to whatever insights, revelations that might be showing up for yourself. Allowing yourself just to be grateful for this moment that we've had in silence. That we had a moment to stop and pause and to be present to the presence. I deeply appreciate the opportunity to be with you. And when you're ready, open your eyes.
Wonderful. Thank you, Marissa.
Yes, thank you.
So on last month's call, on the November call, we talked through the sort of guidelines for one possible structure for an op-ed piece. So I won't go through those again, but you're certainly welcome to listen to the November call, and you can see that action sheet with those guidelines. I'd love to hear and go see if you could tell us a little bit about what your writing process has been like. So you've taken that to heart and you've dove in. Tell us what it's like to write an op-ed. And have you done this before? Is it a new thing?
It's definitely a new thing. It's something I've never done before. I actually really felt drawn to this opportunity, this particular action, primarily because it felt like it gave voice in a way that was meaningful, that was respectful, and that was authentic. And it gave, you know, just the way you had shaped it for us in the November call to help give us those guidelines, that I found that very helpful for me. And in the process, I actually had been, like I shared with you, was going through some things, and it just made me look at the opportunity to share about why we want to, A, deal with the truth and reconciliation, because it's a grander, larger picture. We're talking about being able to honor each other's humanity and to respect each other, not just because of color, because that's one dimension of our humanity, but because we all have humanity and all are deserving of respect and dignity at any given point in life. And so that just felt, it resonated with me as something very powerful to want to share. And I hadn't really been touched quite like that, because I tend to not want to be out there, but it gave me a way to be out there without having to be out there physically in that way. Yeah.
Wonderful. Wonderful. I want to touch on something which I also mentioned on the last call. Some folks might think that, maybe there weren't any lynchings in my county, so this might not apply to me. We tell folks what you discovered. I forget if you said it was a documentary or a...
Yeah, it is. It's a KCET in California. There were lynchings in California. And I just was looking at it briefly. And what I discovered was, which I was quite surprised by, that it wasn't just African Americans. Matter of fact, I didn't even get to a part of... One was a woman who was a Latino woman who was lynched. And one was a man from a different country, from somewhere else other than America, but he came here and he was lynched here. And so what that said to me just briefly, just overnight, just sitting with it, was that this idea of lynching, this idea of punishment, is not necessarily, though African Americans might have experienced it in larger numbers, this idea of some type of harm to another in order to feel like you've rectified a situation has been around for quite some time. And so that actually helped me, which I often try to do, is not colorize in a situation. Like, I realize that African-Americans in America have went through some very atrocious, traumatic events. But I also feel, as a person of color, that just focusing on color and not focusing on the behavior is really dangerous, you know? And so that particular, I can share with you so you can share it with others at a later time, that link, which I did actually, I shared it already. But I think it's really important to look at lynching holistically so that we can see it. And that's what it helped me do immediately. I said, oh, it wasn't just Black people getting lynched. You know, this is somebody, though it wasn't a large number, this is an idea that people utilize to obviously punish. And another thing that really came up for me was this idea that somebody else feels they have the power to make such a choice to take a life. It touches me just even saying it out loud, that anybody feels that they have the right to do that. I don't care what a person's done. None of us have the right, in my opinion, humbly, to take the life of another human being, because we are miraculous creations. And so however we view that, there's a divinity of our human beingness. And so that just really kind of resonates with me right now.
Mm-hmm. And how's the writing going?
I'm still going. I broke my writing down into pieces, which I was sharing with Dan. I find works better for me because, like, as you can tell, I'm thinking again. And so when I'm in my thinking mode, I'm not writing. I'm thinking about and contemplating and reflecting upon the information I've looked at, the experiences I've currently went through, just even at work with in relationship to forms of violence. And now I feel like I have a really good grasp about how I want to approach this, which is not as a woe as me, but more as here's an opportunity for our humanity to evolve, and I get to have a voice in that. Mm-hmm. And so it's not about whether it's a good piece or a bad piece. It's just really about, it's like music. I get to create something and put it out there, and people who want to read it will, and those who don't won't, and that's okay too.
Marvelous. So I want to put a note out there for many folks in much of the country. I think it would probably make a lot of sense to focus pretty straight ahead on Black and white issues. It's a very personal choice, clearly. And there may be counties where a lot of racial violence has had to do with being addressed towards Chinese people who were building the railroads and then driven out of town, sometimes living in underground cities. Certainly violence of settlers towards Native Americans and violence of the government towards Native Americans, and the overall, you know, cultural phenomenon. There's so much to say about that. So depending where you live and what's sort of ripe, there may be avenues to work into your writing that this needs to, you know, move in this direction ultimately or even initially. And for much of the country, I think looking at questions of Black and white or Caucasian and Black and brown, and those divisions, there's a really an opportunity here to have some solidarity around that movement as well. So I encourage folks, you know, read the sample if you like. If you don't want to be prejudiced by someone else's writing, then just, you know, go on your own. Many op-eds will have a requirement of 400 to 600 words, but you might want to look at the paper that you're targeting first. Go to their opinion page, their editorial page, find the requirements for submissions. There'll be some sort of guidelines. If you can't find it, you'll certainly be able to find an email address or phone number for the paper and call them up and say, I'm interested in submitting an essay, an op-ed, or an opinion piece. Tell me how long it has to be. What are your requirements? So that can help you get started and know that you're aiming at the right length. And 500 words is like a page and a half, you know, more or less. It's not a ton of writing, but yeah, the sample could give you some ideas. I don't want to leave too much out, but I think I want to make sure to have time for Kendra and her update. hopefully, I think hearing about your process and Gozi, I think could really inspire folks to just take it on their own terms. So I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
You've made it your own, and I encourage folks to do that. You know, everyone's writing is different. Everyone's, especially in terms of an opinion piece, you're going to have your own flavor, your own style. You can have some sources, some links, because it might get published online. But we'll talk more about that in next week's call, about how to pitch it, how to get it placed. If you haven't already submitted it by next Tuesday, then we can have some strategies around that. I want to welcome Kendra, and I think I've identified her number correctly, and let's have an update regarding the Department of Peacebuilding Committee. So, Kendra, is that you? I just unmuted?
Yes, thank you.
Welcome.
This has been an extraordinary call, and I really appreciate having a few minutes. Interestingly enough, one of our group on the Department of Peacebuilding Committee told us about a video of the Maine Truth and Reconciliation with Native Americans. And we were so excited about that we included it in our suggestions for the new bill, the Department of Peacebuilding legislation, which each Congress, I'm going backwards, each Congress lasts for 2 years, and each bill introduced in that Congress, then if it's not passed during those 2 years, has to be reintroduced. So that's where we are right now. We've just made some suggestions to Representative Barbara Lee, who sponsors our Department of Peacebuilding legislation, and it will be introduced at some point in early 2019, we hope, under the same bill number, H.R. 1111. And so we're asking people also right now to consider sending holiday greetings to their legislators and asking them to consider peacebuilding legislation of whatever is near and dear to your heart. Mm-hmm. This truth and reconciliation, I would think it would be really important for them to hear that there's something going on in the country and that it's in this time of peace. So we need people to contact their own legislators at any time throughout the year, but this seems like a good time. And then coming up will be season for nonviolence, January 30th to April 4th, between the two birthdays death days, actually, of Martin Luther King Jr. and Mahatma Gandhi. And that's another time we contact legislators. And then we're asking the legislators to be original co-sponsors on the bill. We will be having a call on next Wednesday, the third Wednesday of each month, December 18th at 5 p.m. Pacific time. If you are not already one of the people who receives information about those calls, you can send an email to nancy@peacealliance.org to be asked to be put on the list to receive notices about these calls. This is the time when anybody who's interested in this bill and finding out more about it and how they can help is welcome to join the call. You can find out more about what we're doing at the Peace Alliance homepage link to the Department of Peacebuilding, and on the lower right-hand side of the homepage is the Movers and Shakers current edition that you can link on. And then we also just want to let people know that we received the sad news that Mary Alice O'Connor died on December 3rd, and many of the people involved may have met her at Peace Alliance or Department of Peace gatherings in the past. She was remembered for her uplifting spirit and total dedication to peace. So we pass on our condolences. And that's it.
Thank you so much, Kendra. Thanks for all of that. And Mary Alice was on my mind as well. So I'm glad that you mentioned her. I had thought to mention her, but I didn't have it in front of me. So I'm glad you remembered. Yeah, Mary Alice was a regional coordinator and was a development director and a supporter in many ways of our work and ally and solidarity. So of course our thoughts go to her loved ones and our thanks go to her. Mm-hmm. So we're at the top of the hour and I'm very grateful to all of you for being with us. As I mentioned, we're going to have a call a week from tonight to do some further training. I encourage you to, I'm sorry we didn't get around to field shares tonight. I did say we would hear from the field, but I also want to stay in integrity around getting you out of here in under an hour. So maybe I'll ask you to hold on to those field shares and bring them back next week if you can, if something's burning. If you want to make sure that I find out about something, dan@peacealliance.org. It's pretty straightforward. I'll end with a closing quote, which people who've been on calls with me before have certainly heard, one of my favorites from Eleanor Roosevelt, which is that the future belongs to those who believe in the beauty of their dreams.
Yes.
So let me see if I can unmute everybody and say thanks, you all, and very good night.
Good night. Thank you all.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.